Device Nation, the voice of operative orthopedics.
Greetings and solicitations, fellow surgeons and solicitors. Welcome to yet another thrill-packed installment of Device Nation, the voice of operative orthopedics. My name is Kevin Brown, your humble ASR. You're going to want to keep your arms and legs in the ride at all times today. No, it won't be like going to Action Park up in New Jersey, where at one time there was a better than even chance you were going home in an ambulance or a body bag. What is Action Park, you say? Opened in 1978 in Vernon, New Jersey. Many would say it would end up being the most dangerous water park in America. I know a rep that lived near this place. He said all of his friends called it Traction Park. Why? Well, it had attractions like these. The tidal wave pool, nicknamed the Grave Pool. Nearly 30 people a day would need to be rescued from it. Then there was the Alpine Slide, described by many as responsible for at least a good 50% of Zimmer Dermatome blade business in the 80s due to all the skin grafts needed when you inevitably crashed. But the most infamous of them all, the Cannonball Loop, an enclosed water slide with a complete vertical loop. According to one of the employees, park owner Gene Mulville sent a dummy doll on a test run of the ride. It came back with no head. Even with all that, despite employees winding up with injuries, he would literally pay them $100 to try these ride ideas out. He opened the park anyway. Great documentary on what happened next up there in Vernon. It's on Amazon and it's called Class Action Park, of course. And that inspired us to do two things. Number one, never go to a water park again. But number two, to open up our own place here at Device Nation. We're giving away wristbands. You'll have to pay for your own food and beverages, of course, allowing you all access to a family-friendly destination we call Pro Action Park. Side note, this is the exact soundtrack I hear in my mind when I'm working with that scrub tech that checked out years ago, and we're on our fifth total hip of the day, and they're still putting the acetabular shell on the cup inserter backwards. But I digress. Pro action. What does that word even mean? It's action that initiates change as opposed to reaction to events. Isn't that good? I'm going to say it again. It's action that initiates change as opposed to just reacting to events. We're going to talk about that today. And while we're at it, we're throwing a fast pass your direction, escorting you to the front of the line for a super inspiring conversation with Dr. James Hutch Huddleston, newly installed president of AAKUS. You're so going to want to hang around for that. But first, quick review. Last episode, we talked about this four-cylinder engine that runs our industry. Cylinder one, product. When a product gets sold and a PO gets cut, well, that puts everything in motion. Cylinder two, people, the boots on the ground that make all this happen. Cylinder three, process. That's the operations side that manages all the product and the people. And then cylinder four, profit. Not a bad word. This business does not run on air. We'll take you back. Many years ago, most device companies, they ran on just two cylinders, people and product. And the growth was such, profit took care of itself and process, i.e. operations, was just there to support what was going on the sales side. Well, that was then. This is now. We see many companies running on just two cylinders these days, but it's not people and product anymore, right? It's process and profit, and overtaker entrepreneurial reps do not thrive in that model. I see this over and over and over. Success that leads to eventual territories being split up, lines being taken away. You feel like you're pumping air into a balloon with a hole in it, right? So if that's you, speaking of balloons, and you are looking for a solution to all that pumping, it's exhausting, then perhaps consider a trip to a Device Nation's Pro Action Park. As you make your way through the turnstile and look at the map, know you can choose from one of four parks here on the grounds of this family-friendly destination. Number one, the Do Nothing Park, the most popular section. So many caretakers and undertakers book this area, so you'll need to get there early. So easy to find. No monorail needed. You're already there. No additional thinking or effort. You don't have to change a thing. Just keep your head down, resting in the supreme satisfaction of earning less every year for doing more. Let's turn our attention back to your map. To your left is a path to the Bloom Where You're Planted Park. There's no monorail. Put your Hoka 1-1s on as it's a long walk. It takes a lot of effort to get there. And once you arrive, you will not be able to rest. No benches. There's a front door you're going to have to walk through, and then you're going to have to work on it as ASP declines. That means more of your money is being carted out your back door by a small car filled with clowns. You have no option if you want to make more money next year to cover braces, a new car for Junior, and your daughter's wedding. You're going to need more money in that front door to offset it. We've talked about BMPs to accomplish this, products and services that aren't metal and plastic. We've talked partnering with your hospital and your surgeons to find creative ways to bundle and save, identify things that can help make them more money. This park might make the most sense for you If you like where you are and you don't want to move, just know that it will involve doing something. As we turn our attention back to the map, you'll see an area where the fence seems to be missing. That's on purpose. 1 foot in, 1 foot out park. No traditional rides here. You'll still be on the property just doing different things like working for the facility. Six-figure jobs to be had as SPD technicians these days. Crazy, right? I know a rep that's working in material management now and absolutely loves her job. One rep that became a purchasing director. Now he gets the opportunity to kick non-compliant reps out of the park. Tons of fun there. Tons of opportunities on the hospital ASC admin side of this industry. Now, for the three people left, let's complete our tour by following me to my favorite section, the independent rep park. This park is the closest thing to Action Park you're going to find in this industry, as it is fraught, sounds so country when I say that, fraught with high risk and high reward. It's the most exciting part of the park for overtaker reps, not for the faint of heart, but I have thoroughly enjoyed selling funnel cakes here. If you have any questions on what the device sales version of the Alpine ride could look like for you, DM me on LinkedIn after the tour, and I will give you the ins and outs of it all. Well, Device Nation exited through that hole in the fence in Pro Action Park recently for a behind-the-scenes look at something super exciting coming down the pike. You heard it here first. The Instrumentum Beta facility in Boca Raton, Florida. Ever hear of off-site sterile processing for the ASC? It is absolutely coming our way, and it will be an amazing ride for overtaker reps, surgeons, facilities, and industry. What is off-site sterile processing, Kevin? I've heard about it. I want to learn more. Well, in a nutshell, let's look at Monday. You just walked out of that last case of the day, and for many of us, then our second job begins, right? Well, in this scenario, you can leave. Instrumentum picks up the trays, takes them offsite to be processed in a decontam facility. It's like an Intel clean room. Everything's documented. Much like the Domino's pizza tracker, you know where everything is at all times. You even have pictures on your phone of what's in the trays before they get delivered for cases the next day in rigid containers. No more holes, sterile every time. Now for reps, going back to what we talked about before, you're going to have time now to focus on your front door as Instrumentum. They're going to be taking care of everything on the instrument side for you. Happy days are here again. Rep called me up the other day. His company just dropped 2 points off their commission rate for his particular team. That was the equivalent of one ASR's pay. Two cylinder profit and process companies are not going to pay us six figures to run totes around and put trays together. I'm so excited about this aspect of Instrumentum, freeing us all from the tyranny of operations and a declining income. Now, what about for everybody else? For surgeons, best-in-class logistics is going to change the discussion from how many cases can they do to how many do they want to do. Facilities, now they can free up capital, reallocate resources, repurpose space. Instruments are off-site now. That storage room could now become a money-generating OR suite. Now, lastly, what about the company or companies we all work for? Will they want to visit this section of Pro Action Park? Yes, as the value prop is huge. They will want capacity in these facilities. Instrument sets are incredibly expensive. This will allow them to do more with less. Check it all out at instrumentum.com. Well, we introduced you all last episode to the official quote of Pro Action Park, courtesy of Jared James. Perhaps you saw it on the arch as you walked in the park. Change is not what eliminates people. The inability to pivot and adjust with that change is what eliminates people. Well, our next guest is on the tip of the spear of change on behalf of the 5,300 AUKUS members facing their own version of Pro Action Park. Don't you miss that amusement park music already? All looking at creative ways to pivot and adjust. Just like we are. Get ready to take some notes, Dr. James Huddleston. What an honor. Welcome to Device Nation, sir.
Thank you very much for having me, Kevin. It's great to be with you.
It's such a privilege to have you on the show. Your CV left my printer begging for mercy. So look forward to opening all that up. But first, we got to get some important business out of the way, sir. I have heard you referred to as Hutch my entire career. Where did that nickname come from?
I don't know for sure, but the story goes that my grandfather on his deathbed requested that I be called Hutch, probably because I was officially named the third. I also have a half brother whose name is James Walden, so we share a first name. So the Huddleston family wasn't terribly creative with their naming, but that's how the story goes.
I was reading just this morning about an orthopedic surgeon in Naples by your same name. I'm assuming there's got to be a connection there, right?
And that's my father.
Well, that puts a lot of things together. That explains why I read that he was in Kenya around the same time you were in Kenya, right?
Yeah, no, we traveled together.
What an awesome story. He seemed like he's made quite an impact over his career.
Yeah, no, he had a wonderful career. And, you know, he was certainly my inspiration for going into orthopedics. And it helps when you have exposure to something at an early age when you're impressionable, because it leaves a big impact. But he paved the way for me, and I wouldn't be where I am today without his guidance and, you know, exposing me to various things over the years with regard to orthopedics.
Dr. Huddleston, we always enjoy asking our guests what put them on the path to medicine. Always seems to be an interesting story there. Was it just baked in for you from the beginning? Any twists and turns, or was it joint replacement from the word go?
Yeah, so it wasn't joint replacement from the start, but I was always interested in orthopedics. So I had exposure from my dad, but I also played sports growing up. I had a lot of exposure to athletic trainers and sports injuries and things like that. So those two things, I would say, really are what got me started down this path. And I was fairly sure at an early age, for better or worse, that this is what I wanted to do. I was one of the lucky folks who was able to actually make it happen.
Speaking of sports, sir, my son was a lacrosse goalie. One of the more painful things to watch as a parent, as his shins really took a beating. I understand you were a coach for the University of Vermont.
Yes. So I played lacrosse in college. I was a defenseman at Yale, and I coached for a year at the University of Vermont with head coach named Jeff Thompson, who was a wonderful guy. And my brother actually played on the team at that time. I'm in my eighth year of coaching a club team here called the Menlo Atherton Grizzlies. First 7 years were coaching my son, who's now a freshman in high school, so he's aged out. But I have my first team this year without my son on it, which is exciting. It's a 14U team. So I still enjoy coaching. I love being around the young guys. It's a lot of fun. It helps keep me young. And, you know, it's a wonderful game. The rate limiting step in terms of the growth is really the lack of coaches. So being able to give back to that, you know, try to help fill the ranks for our high school team, so to speak.
Well, you certainly filled the ranks, sir, at Mass General for your residency and fellowship. Any recollections from your time there at that incredible institution?
Oh, yeah. Honestly, I wouldn't know where to start. Residency is a very, very memorable time in one's life. Learning and working at a very prestigious institution with a very eclectic group of characters teaching you is something that really leads to there never being a dull moment. So I don't know that I would have one story I could tell you, but it was a wonderful place to train. I'm very fortunate to have been able to have that experience. A lot of the folks who trained me, actually, my dad had helped train when they were residents. So that was very special for me. But I had a wonderful residency class, still keep in touch with all of them. And it really was just a wonderful experience. And I'm very, very fortunate to have been able to be part of the group and learn there. And you talk about the building blocks of who you are as a doctor and how you practice. There's no question that the standards that are held there are very high, and I like to think that I aspire to keep them high in my own practice.
Big fast forward, 25 years later, here you are, professor of orthopedic surgery at Stanford University. Tell us about your practice. What does it look like? What are you doing these days?
So I do primarily hip and knee replacement now. And as you know, I've been here for 20 years, and it's a saturated area. So even working at a large institution, when you arrive, not too many people in the community are happy to see you. But, you know, once you get to know them and you do a good job, you tend to make friends. So I have a great practice. You know, it's a mature practice at this point. I have as much work as I want to do. And it's a nice mix between sort of routine primaries and revisions, which I still like to do. It's very rewarding to be able to teach fellows and residents and medical students on a regular basis, which goes on all the time. So it's really a wonderful practice. It is certainly challenging given the different facets of it, but I'm very fortunate to be where I am.
What's your favorite procedure?
I would have told you that I like doing hip replacements the most probably 15 years ago, but now I would say I like doing knee replacements the most.
Well, one thing I feel confident that is a favorite of yours, sir, is research. First place research prize all the way back in 1999 at the Vermont College of Medicine. Looking at your CV, sir, your passion for it is obvious. What drives you to discover?
When you spend as much time doing what we do, you know where all the problems are. When we see problems that are not good for our patients, but also not good for us and not good for the system, it's only natural that you'd want to try to fix them. So, you know, I see a very wide range of pathology in my practice. You know, we see things that need to be answered and need to be fixed all the time, and work in a place where it's expected that you would, you know, be curious, want to solve problems and answer questions.
One research award that I noted among many of yours was an OCCAS Clinical Research Award centered around direct anterior. What did you find?
The direct anterior approach to total hip arthroplasty was popularized by Joel Mata. The scuttlebutt, when it started to be disseminated as a procedure, was that all the patients got better faster.
Right.
From my own observations, being a tertiary referral center, I wasn't sure that I agreed with that. So we took a group of patients that we'd put together actually to look at a acetabular bearing surface that was the first one investigated that was doped with an antioxidant. So that was the cohort, and we had 1,000 patients from 17 international centers. We had lots of patient reported outcome scores, and we had a lot of the European surgeons doing lateral approaches, and then a nice smattering of people doing posterior approaches, and then some anterior approaches, primarily with Roger Emerson in Texas. That was a convenient sample to be able to look at from the patient's perspective, you know, how they felt they did at what time point. And what we found was that the patients who had a posterior approach actually got better a little bit faster than the patients who had an anterior approach. So
Wow. That
was not something that would be considered the common wisdom at that time when we won the award several years ago, but that was the crux of it.
Well, Dr. Huddleston, would love to ask you a question right there. Conventional wisdom at the time vitamin E was released, hey, we're going to put this scavenger in there. It's going to address all that oxygen floating around in the joint space. Has time been kind to that original premise?
So the short answer is it has, but that's with an asterisk. So the scene in 2005 or so was that it was really a three-horse race, right? You know this well. So there was metal on metal was gaining popularity and market share. And then you had old polyethylene, but you also had ceramics. And at that time, nobody really knew who was going to win. Now, it's pretty obvious now that, you know, the majority of bearing surfaces in the United States are ceramic head on a cross-linked polyethylene liner. But with some of the original highly cross-linked polyethylenes, there was some concern for in vivo oxidation. The question was why. I think that's been answered basically due to squalene and then cyclic loading. With that being said, at the time, the thought was, okay, if you can get a material that's more oxidatively stable, that should prevent any of this in vivo oxidation, the problems associated with that down the line, mainly wear. The second generation highly cross-linked polyethylenes have all performed very, very well, as have some of the first generation. So the benefit of the antioxidant, I would say today, hasn't necessarily borne out, but it certainly wasn't a bad addition to the polyethylene. Hips are lasting longer than they ever have now, so it'll be interesting to see into the third decade whether the oxidatively stabilized polyethylenes actually have benefit. But as of today, I would say there's very little benefit over adding the antioxidant compared to a good highly cross-linked liner. But most importantly, it didn't harm anything.
Over 150 peer-reviewed publications, sir. If you had to pick one that you're most proud of, and that might be a hard question to answer, is there one in particular that jumps out at you that like, wow, that was big?
You know, there's been a bunch of good ones, I would say. Things that you've done recently are always probably the freshest.
Right.
But we just published a paper on a novel dynamic force-controlled balancer for knee replacement that we mated with a navigation system, with the idea being that, you know, is there an optimal position for the femoral component in a gap balancing technique that would optimize the ligament tension throughout the entire arc of motion rather than just at full extension and 90 degrees of flexion. And so we developed this technology with ExactTech. We mated it with the navigation. And then we basically went through the process of showing that the device actually does what it does, i.e. it can deliver a quasi-static force regardless of the displacement. And then we showed that surgeons can get it to work. Then I compared 100 of my patients who I did with the traditional gap balancing technique at orienting the femoral component in the axial plane just at 0 and 90 degrees, and comparing that to picking a position based on the information from the dynamic balancer if there would be a different position that would be better potentially to optimize the stability of the knee. And what we found is that based on knee society scores, we did see improved results with the new balancer that were both statistically and clinically significant. So if you look at hips and knees, you know, part of the reason you ask me, what do I like more, hips or knees? Hips work really well. Other than infection, there's not much really left to solve with hip replacement. It's arguably the most effective medical intervention of all time. You know, we've done a lot of work on improving stability of the hip and reducing dislocation. And so I think that that problem, although it's not entirely solved, the rates are certainly lower than they have been. So we're all proud of that for those of us who worked on it. But, you know, knees, we still have historically in aggregate anyways, 15% of patients who are not happy. And there's no question that a large group of those patients who aren't happy probably have some degree of instability. So if we can figure out a better position to put the knee in and make it simple for people to do, that would really be a big advancement in our field. So that paper should be available online already. And if it's not, it will be in the next few days. But I would say that's probably my favorite paper at the moment.
We will certainly link that in the show notes. I am so glad you brought up that ExactTech Newton, Dr. Huddleston. I got a chance to actually test drive that at the last AAKUS meeting. Super impressed with not only that, but their new polyethylene and new CEO, Darren Johnson. Great things going on down there in Gainesville, and we are cheering them on. Well, you did a presentation that had a lot of people cheering you on in Montreal recently entitled Lessons Learned from Building and Running a National Registry. Where are we on a national registry here in the U.S.?
You know, we've made great progress on the registry. There's no question about that. We have over 3 million procedures, 1,500 hospitals, 5,000 surgeons. The volume in the registry represents approximately 40% of all the hip and knee replacements done in the United States. So we're all very proud of that. The registry was created basically to figure out what's going into people and how is it performing. So essentially post-market surveillance. And there's really inherent value in that. So that's great. But I think we've achieved that goal. The model for the American Joint Replacement Registry, which is, you know, really the cornerstone of the Academy's registry efforts, was that we would have a multi-stakeholder board. So there are representatives from surgeons, obviously, but patients, industry, hospitals, and also payers. So what we hear from our multi-stakeholder group is that what we're hearing about the metal and plastic is great, but what we really need, especially from the hospital side and the payer side, is that they want to see real quality improvement data.
Right.
To get to that, you need to have ways to collect more granular data, such as what's the rate of blood transfusions, and did the patient have transaxamic acid, and did they get out of bed on postoperative day zero for physical therapy. So getting that data is really what our focus is now. We all think at this point, what we really need to get to that next level, we think the technology will get there shortly with machine learning and large language models so that we do not have to have boots on the ground or abstractors to actually get the data out of the EHR. But to get this effort to the next level, I think we're pretty much in agreement that we need to have a federal mandate. That's what the other large international registries, such as in Australia, England and Wales, Scotland, Scandinavian countries, Germany, they all have backing by the government and financing by the government, and it's mandatory. And we need that now. Now, this is obviously a much bigger country with a much more diverse and complicated healthcare delivery system. But what we really need is a mandate. And so this year, this is my second of 3 years as the chair of the American Joint Replacement Registry Steering Committee. I'm also the 34th president of the American Association of Hip and Knee Surgeons. So this is really going to be my focus this year of trying to get our plan together and submission for a federal mandate for American Joint Replacement Registry. And there's precedent for that already. And this is in several of the cardiology registries, especially those with ICDs, are federally funded and mandated. So we need to get to that point, especially when you're talking about a line item like hip and knee replacement, which is, you know, one of the biggest, if not the biggest, financial expenditures for the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. There's all kinds of ways that the registry add values now. So you can use it for advanced certification for hip and knee replacement through the Joint Commission. You can use it for getting credit for maintenance certification through the Academy. There's various insurance programs for gold carding, getting waivers on pre-authorization, things like that. And now for the federal mandate for patient reported outcome measure collection, the Academy and AJR is very well suited to facilitate with collection of those outcome instruments. So the registry is alive and well. We're keeping our eye on the ball, but we really would like to expand our value proposition, and we have good alignment of the stars to do that. So we're going to make a big formal push coming up.
Dr. Huddleston, a lot of chatter out there about the potential for technology to move the needle on some of this registry data. Any predictions on the future of these gadgets a lot of us use to put the implants in?
Yeah, so we may see a pretty quick shift here in the marketplace in terms of which institutions are even doing hip and knee replacement, because the penalty for not achieving the goals that CMS has set forth with the IQR, which is inpatient quality reporting, PROPM, so patient reported outcome performance measure. So the bar is pretty high for collection and showing that your patients are getting better. So we think, especially with the margins decreasing for hip and knee replacement in terms of reimbursement to hospitals, that there'll be institutions that say, we're just not going to do this. It's not worth our time because we can't afford to have the penalty. That'll create a shift for sure. In terms of metal and plastic, so I told you hip replacement is essentially one of the most effective medical interventions of all times. We know how to put it in well. We've reduced the dislocation risk primarily with our greater understanding now of the hip-spine relationship. And so other than infection, you know, as long as you can get the parts in right for hip replacement, it works well. The bearing surface works well. It's probably not going to wear out. So technology definitely can help on the hip side. And whether that's robotics or navigation, whatever it is, it's going to help. And if you consider the fact that many of the hip replacements done in the United States are done by folks who don't do a whole lot each month, that's going to help them do a better job. So I think it has some utility on the hip side. On the knee side, there's no question that it will have a significant influence there. And I think it already is with robotics and navigation. The same situation. Many knee replacements are done by people who don't do a whole lot. In theory, the enabling technology should allow them to put the implants in a better position, and that should result in better outcomes. And we're already starting to see that. We've seen that with navigation for sure in terms of increased survivorship, decreased revisions due to mechanical loosening, improved patient-reported outcomes, and certainly greater precision, and what we hope is greater accuracy. Now, the accuracy picture is a different story because, you know, there's a lot of different ways to do a knee replacement. None of them actually get the knee patients need to function the way they did before they had arthritis, which would be the holy grail. But think of the enabling technologies are here to stay, and the value proposition will be favorable once we get a little bit further down the road.
That inpatient quality reporting, that's coming up on us pretty quick, right? Am I remembering July?
Well, the rubber hits the road on April 1st. So you have a three-month preoperative window to collect the PROs for the pre-op assessment, and the case requirements start in July. So Monday, April 1st, we start.
Buckle up. Change is on the way. Well, one organization, Dr. Huddleston, has been moving the needle since its inception, AAKUS. Consistent growth since 1991, 5,300 surgeons and HCPs strong. What do you attribute that consistent growth to?
You know, AAKUS was created to be the society for basically the whole arthroplasty community, right? So we have the Academy, which is similar, but it's a much larger organization. So AAKUS is obviously a little bit more focused on just hip and knee replacement. So it's a smaller group inherently. You know, it's the society for everybody. Everybody does hip and knee replacement. We want you to be a member. And right. The meeting has grown because it's been run well. It's in a place that people can get to. It's at a good time of year. The length of the meeting is right now. You know, we have a lot of educational offerings, but we have, you know, the cornerstone of the meeting is new research, and it is pretty much the best new research every year. The process to have a podium and a poster is very, very competitive. Yeah. We get over 2,000 abstracts. So the people who do hip and knee replacement, they're very dedicated to the profession. They like sharing stories and learning from each other, and AAKUS has really provided that forum, and I think that's what fuels the growth.
I believe you've been an AAKUS member since 2009. You recently just took office as the 34th president of this incredible organization. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
You took the captain's chair in February of an organization known for education, advocacy, and research. Just curious, Dr. Huddleston, what's your vision for AAKUS?
So AAKUS is a very well-oiled machine. There's a lot of passionate members. The leadership is very passionate, and the staff who runs it is very skilled. So really, the first thing that I would tell you that any president needs to do is basically just to keep the ship sailing. sailing straight. That will be my focus for sure. Now, that being said, that's pretty easy to do given the infrastructure in place. Now, there will be things that come up, I'm sure, that will be challenging over the year, but I think we're well suited and experienced to deal with them. In terms of my own interests, what I would like to do, my first priority as president, other than keeping the ship going straight, is to really try to get together the Academy and AUKUS to pool our resources and figure out a strategy to get the federal government to agree to have a mandate for submitting to the American Joint Replacement Registry. So that's the first thing that I'm doing. The other thing we're doing, and you know, I got to this position in the leadership by being involved on the advocacy side. I was chair of the Health Policy Council after being chair of the advocacy committee. We hear a lot that our reimbursement continues to go down and the advocacy efforts, despite the large budget that we have, doesn't really prevent that from happening. And so what are we going to do differently? The bottom line is we don't have a lot of control. We need to have a seat at the table. And most of what we do on the reimbursement side is about mitigating losses, because as I said, we don't have a lot of controls. So we hear, well, why don't we unionize? Well, you know, you can unionize if you have the same employer. And the reason physicians historically haven't unionized is because we don't all have the same employer. Right. But there are increasing unionization efforts among residents at various parts in the country and even physicians in various parts of the country, including here at Santa Clara Valley Medical Center in San Jose. So we're going to put together, and we're about to release it, essentially what the rules are on local unionization and, you know, how you would do that and what it would look like. And these are the folks who have experience with it. That's the second thing. And then the third thing that we are going to make a formal request for to CMS is for this concept of Centers of Excellence for Treatment of Periprosthetic Joint Infection. This is being led by Tom Fehring, who's the past president. We've spent a lot of time gathering data on opinions of AUKUS members and financial data on, you know, how this would look, who would pay for it, how much money it would save the government. So it's something that we are in favor of. Operationalizing it in the mechanics certainly have to be determined. We're not there yet, and we certainly don't have all the answers, but we are going to raise it with CMS and see what they have to say. So those are really the three main things, other than the usual day-to-day work that I'm going to focus on over the course of this year.
On behalf of Device Nation, sir, I just want to stop for a second and thank you for your political engagement and advocacy. You've been doing a lot of that over the years. Any takeaways from all your PAC work?
Yeah, thanks for that. It's a labor of love. You know, if you asked me 15 years ago, would I be doing this, I would tell you no. But it's just something that sort of came about. I had an opportunity to be on the advocacy committee, and then I've really enjoyed it. And it's a fascinating process. It's a maddening one because we don't have a lot of control over it.
Right.
You know, what I like about it is that I learned the ropes from the people who were where I am now in terms of the leadership of AUKUS. This isn't stuff that you can read in a book. You can't learn how to do it by reading in a book. You have to have boots on the ground, so to speak. And it's word of mouth and it's knowledge that's passed on from person to person. So, you know, I was fortunate to have people teach me about it and give me opportunities to be engaged. And I just want to give that back to the next generation so they're hopefully better equipped to deal with the inevitable challenges that live ahead.
Speaking of challenges, sir, what do you see as a primary challenge facing your members right now?
There's no doubt that continued downward pressure on reimbursement and loss of physician autonomy are the two biggest challenges to our members.
Any thoughts on what opportunities your members should be considering to grow their practice, manage their practice over the next 5 years?
Yeah, so I wish I could tell you that I had some rosy news to tell you or some answers, but I definitely don't. You know, the rubber's hitting the road here where we're seeing more consolidation. That's not going to help access. And we see surgeons retiring, and that's not going to help access. We see surgeons limiting their practice. That's not going to help access. We're at a breaking point for sure. You know, one of the saddest statistics is that if you look at what our reimbursement is relative to the MEI or Medicare Economic Index, we're not even keeping up with inflation.
That's right.
You know, I won't go too deeply into this, but everybody else is always getting paid more and the physicians are always getting paid less. So the hospitals are getting paid more, insurance companies are getting paid more, nurses are getting paid more, hospital administrators are getting paid more, and the doctors are getting paid less. And the reason in part that that happens is because the doctors like what they do and they have a commitment to the patients to take care of them and to do what we signed up for and what we went to school for a long time. So, you know, we've really been taken advantage of in that regard. And I think we're becoming more educated, but you have to continue to educate the politicians about what's actually going on. There are a lot of obstacles that I don't really know that we can overcome, unfortunately. But a work stoppage, which is what a union gets you, is a very powerful thing. You know, I really hope it doesn't get to the point where we have a national work stoppage, but that's certainly being talked about quite a bit. As I said, I wish I had rosier things to say to folks. folks, but I don't. But I will make the plug that folks need to be engaged. It takes time away from your practice, and that means you're giving up revenue opportunities. But you got to give a little to get a little. So the more people we have engaged in this effort, hopefully the better chance we have of righting the ship.
You know, I can't take credit for this number because I learned it from you watching one of your presentations. Joint replacement is over 10% now of Medicare's budget. I think a work stoppage would certainly get their attention with that kind of percentile.
Oh, I think they're terrified of a work stoppage, and they've heard it and they know it. But the problem is when we go up to Capitol Hill in a nice suit and we're going into meetings with representatives from CMS, and the group before us is the hospital lobby and the group after us is the payer lobby, you realize that it's all a big game. We're just one of the many folk who are trying to get a seat at the table. Right. And at the end of the day, on the congressional side, in most districts, the largest employer is the hospital. The folks in Congress know that. So they're going to look to their biggest constituency group, and that's not the doctors. And everybody has the perception that the doctors are doing just fine. And the doctors are doing fine compared to the average person. I understand that. But what's not talked about is the 10 or 15 years that we spent being educated at 3 and 4 times the pace of the next professionals and volume of material, and the sacrifices that we made to have to be able to be proficient at what we do. So right. It's by no means fair. I would never trade what I would do. And the other thing is that the payers and the folks in Congress, they know that. And they know that from surveys that most doctors, if you ask them if they would do it again, they say they would do it again. That's how satisfying it is. So there's a lot of forces against us, but, you know, life's not fair, and we'll keep on fighting.
In the absence of a solution from Washington, is the only answer really available to surgeons is more volume?
So, yeah. So any time that reimbursement is reduced, volume goes up, right? That's been shown in just about every subspecialty. That's what's happening, but I don't think people can do any more than they're doing now, honestly. Like, I don't, and they certainly don't want to do more. That's not fair to the patients. You know, this is a taxing lifestyle. It's very physical. There's a lot of stress involved. I don't think people doing more is the answer, certainly not in the long term.
Great thoughts there, Doctor. Not everybody is excited about adding 10 by 10 to their OR schedule. Well, Dr. Huddleston, we've been throwing around that word AUKUS today, and when most of our listeners think of AUKUS, they think of the fall meeting in Texas. I plan on attending my first spring meeting in Atlanta May 2nd through the 4th as a press member. Super honored, super excited. Any reasons you'd like to share with the audience as to why they should save the date and come to Buckhead this year?
Yeah, so the spring meeting is a lot different than the fall meeting, so it's a small group format. You have much more interaction with the faculty. I think we have a world-class faculty. We're at a new location this year in Buckhead in Atlanta, and I have not been to the hotel yet, but I hear it's a fantastic hotel. It's wonderful grounds, and the meeting space is very nice. So we hope to see you there. We do think it will be a wonderful educational experience, and the more folks that we can get to come, the better off.
So looking forward to this meeting, sir. So looking forward to shaking your hand as we look forward to the future of orthopedic surgery. You certainly have your hand in training residents and fellows. Any advice to surgeons just getting started out in the current climate?
We train a lot of residents and fellows. We have 3 fellows a year. We have 7 residents a year. And I always tell them that they're starting a practice is really a very trying time in your life. A lot of times you have a young family, you're living in a new place, you don't really know what you've gotten yourself into. Many people change jobs after the first 2 years. You know, in addition to helping people try to find the right opportunity where they'll be successful, the thing that I always tell folks is that you need to get most of the joy out of your day in taking care of patients. So doing the operation, making rounds on them, seeing them in the office. There will be 1,000 distractions and 1,000 other things every day that you will have to focus on. But you need to come back to that, and you need to try to keep in perspective that at the end of the day, you will really have changed a bunch of people's lives in a very favorable way, in a very, very impactful and powerful way that very few other people can do. At the worst of times, on the worst of your day, if you cannot lose sight of that, that'll help get you through the lows.
Dr. Huddleston, something you are clearly gifted at is your ability to navigate these leadership and organizational roles. And you challenged surgeons earlier to get involved. What would that look like? Advice for them as they're thinking, you know, I want to dip my toe in these waters. What would next steps look like?
Yeah, if you want to be involved, you will get opportunities. You might not get more than one opportunity, but if you do get an opportunity, You want to take advantage of it and you want to do your best job. And if you do that, that'll lead to more opportunities. But, you know, there's no question that, you know, you have a significant impact on people's lives, taking care of one patient at a time. But if you get involved in more of the business of medicine, especially on the education and advocacy side, certainly on the research side, you have the ability to impact many more people with less time, a more holistic approach. So I think if you view it as, oh, this isn't just me being on a committee, and you keep in focus what the bigger picture is and how you may be influencing that, that really should get you excited.
Great advice. What about advice for reps? You've certainly seen your share of us come through your operating room throughout your career. Any sage words of wisdom for them?
People say life's all about relationships, and I certainly agree with that. I've seen a lot of good reps. One of the things they all have in common is that they all have excellent social and emotional intelligence, and they understand that. Many reps, if you get comfortable with a rep and they change their company, many people change what implants they use because they like the service and they like the friendship. I've been blessed with wonderful reps along the way. Some of my, I consider excellent friends, and some come, some go, and even the ones that go, I still stay in touch with. So I think people who gravitate towards being a rep already know that. But I just want to say that they need to realize they have a special skill that not everybody has. And they should be really proud of that and continue to foster it, because that's really the key to their success.
I remember this song back from the 80s, "We're in this love together." I feel like a lot of the challenges that your side of the table is experiencing, we're in the same boat with you. We're going through it as well.
Oh, without any doubt. The downward pressure on implant prices is a real thing, and there's no end in sight. You know, I really couldn't agree with you more.
Well, Dr. Huddleston, I just want to say well done. You've accomplished so much over the last 30 years. What's next for you?
Oh, I still have a lot on my plate now, so I just want to see through my current commitments.
Right.
After that, I don't know. I still have a lot of energy. I think there's a lot of things still left need to be done. But, you know, at the end of the day, as I said, I always come back to the fact that I have a wonderful job. I wouldn't trade it for anything. You know, we're still trying to take one day at a time.
Well, you've laid down some real legacy stuff. You're going to be an awesome president of this legacy organization. I so appreciate you coming on Device Nation to share your story, sir.
Well, Kevin, thanks very much for having me. It was a wonderful discussion, and I appreciate the opportunity, and I look forward to meeting you in Atlanta.
Wow. What a conversation. What an inspiring figure in our space. He actually gets me excited about a work stoppage. How many people could say that? Dr. James Hutch Huddleston, a huge Device Nation thank you for your insights and your leadership. Change is on the way, and the overtakers among us know that being in the right section of ProAction Park at the right time will help them successfully navigate through it all. So if you're a surgeon, rep, or industry leader listening, where do you see yourself at ProAction Park in 2024? How do we all free ourselves from the tyranny of operations to grow our business in a way, a sane way, so that we are at the table and not on the menu? Well, Instrumentum could well be a piece of that puzzle. Make sure to check it out at instrumentum.com. Don't forget, your surgeons are walking around the park too. So instead of pitching yet another robot at the scrub sink, perhaps we just open up a conversation about IQR and all these other headwinds coming their way this year. How do they plan on pivoting? Their answer may open the door for you to visit a whole new section of ProAction Park and change the trajectory of your career. How's that for a park pass? And nobody gets hurt. Let's close up with a great quote by Eric Ries. Quote, "A pivot is a change in strategy without a change in vision," unquote. Isn't that good? Device Nation is so committed to searching out potential pivots for our incredible audience. That's what Beyond Metal and Plastic is all about, not just a cute hashtag. That's what our trip to Boca was about. That's what our trip to the spring meeting is going to be about. If you're there, we'd love to shake your hand. If you ever just want to brainstorm what part of ProAction Park might make sense for you, reach out to us anytime at thedevicenation@gmail.com. We are here to serve you the best of the best. And make sure you don't go home in an ambulance. Hope you all have a wonderful week. Hope you have a great day in the OR, and so look forward to working on that front door alongside you all.